Well, welcome everyone to the Neurology Live MS Compass Guiding Clinical Care Podcast. Tune in to hear how MS specialists and other experts translate the latest updates in MS research into actual clinical practice. I'm Dr. Lindsay Ross, and I'm a staff neurologist at the Cleveland Clinic Mellon Center for Multiple Sclerosis Treatment and Research, and I'm your host. In this episode, I'm going to break with the old etiquette rule of avoiding discussing the taboos of sex, money, religion, or politics in the first meeting, as I'm thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Tammy Kaplan to discuss sexual dysfunction in persons with MS. And perhaps by the end of this podcast, you'll be throwing out that etiquette in your practice too. Dr. Kaplan's an assistant professor at the Harvard Medical School and vice chair of education for the neurology department at the Mass General and Brigham Hospital. Dr. Kaplan's a neuroimmunologist, clinician researcher with a particular interest in sexual and bladder dysfunction in persons with MS.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm really glad that we're talking about this because sexual dysfunction is common in people with MS and it affects quality of life and relationships and mood and self-image in so many ways, yet it's so often underrecognized in our routine care. So I'm so happy that you're doing this because I really hope that this can be a part of our comprehensive care for our MS patients.
Yes, I agree. It's definitely a topic deserving of more attention. So excited in this podcast to get into some recent research updates. But first, spending some time going back through an overview of assessing and treating sexual dysfunction, to your point, a topic that many of us practicing seeing patients with MS don't maybe do as much as we could and can use a little bit more background with. So perhaps it'd be fair to start with trying to define the scope of what is sexual dysfunction in MS.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start because, you know, I think people often are confused when we even talk about like what's sexual dysfunction. And to be perfectly honest, when it comes to sexual dysfunction in women, I think that has been even more of an enigma for people because they're not really sure what that even means. And so just broadly speaking, when we think about problems with sexual dysfunction, we have to think about the sexual cycle. So there's several components, and there can be sort of problems all along the way or in one particular area. There's sexual desire, or what people call libido, sexual arousal, and that includes for males erectile function and for females vaginal lubrication. And then lastly, there's orgasmic function. And for males, that means ejaculation. And so, you know, the first sort of step is like, well, where and what is the problem? And sexual function is so complicated in terms of like the neuroanatomy. It's, you know, it's almost funny why we're not talking about this. It's like a fascinating part of neurology because there's this interesting interaction between the neurologic, the vascular, the endocrine factors, all influenced by psychosocial aspects too. And so there's key brain regions that are important, including, you know, cortical regions and the limbic system, but also the autonomic nervous system.
I like that framework of the sexual cycle a lot. I think to your point, it can get overwhelming to try to put that in front of a patient and or even other clinicians and just bring that up. And I think that's a nice sort of framework in thinking about this. And as we, you know, sort of talk about that framework and the scope of what sexual dysfunction includes, you mentioned early on too that this is a common problem in MS. And maybe, you know, now with that in mind about the broad spectrum of how this can come up for patients and their significant others, I mean, how common is this in MS? Can you try to put that in perspective?
That's a really good question too, because, you know, there's a lot of different studies, and depending on the study that you read, you'll see different prevalence percentages, which range from about 40 to 90%. So much of that depends too on how sexual function or dysfunction or sexual problems were assessed and what populations they were looking at. But I'd say, you know, it's higher. It has routinely been reported as much higher than we see in the general population.
Yeah, so I think quite a recent meta-analysis out in the last couple of years that put for males and females, the percentage of sexual dysfunction in persons with MS sort of in that low 60s%. But you're right, I've seen a study in Italian women that puts it as low as 42%, one in Turkish women that's up at 74%. So of course, cultural factors may be influencing that, how the questions are asked, what's included, like you said, in that scope, sort of the sexual cycle. Did we think about all of those parts? And that makes it really hard to pin down. But like you said, seems to be there in the majority of MS patients.
And I think the other big thing is to think about the framework in how we're thinking about sexual function or dysfunction. And I mentioned the sexual cycle, but when it comes to MS specifically, there's a framework that was developed by Foley and colleagues a while ago, where they discussed that there can be sort of primary, secondary, and tertiary sexual dysfunction. And many patients, both males and females, are likely experiencing all of these things in various degrees. And so maybe it makes sense to sort of take a step back and think about, like, what do we mean by this? So primary dysfunction means that there is coming from the neurologic disease itself. Like, there's something about the nervous system that is affecting someone's sexual function. So, for example, someone has decreased genital sensation. And these are where we see those specific issues, you know, in various parts of that sexual cycle. Secondary dysfunction is all the other stuff that comes with MS, right? All those like symptoms that people are experiencing of fatigue, spasticity, weakness, and side effects from medications that are all contributing to sexual problems. And then tertiary sexual dysfunction is the sort of psychosocial and emotional aspect of sexuality, where someone's perception of self or their sexual confidence might be different, you know, after they've experienced some level of disability or any of the other aspects of MS. So I think it's important to sort of think through those things and you know, how what patients are actually dealing with.
Those can be difficult to untangle at times, but I think you bring up a good point, because I think if I'm sitting in front of a patient and I just ask them if they have sexual dysfunction, but they have, you know, lower extremity spasticity that's getting in their way, some patients would say yes and some would say no to me if I just posed it that way, without sort of working through the framework and putting that into perspective. So when you're thinking about assessing sexual dysfunction with a patient in front of you, do you have a particular approach that you follow, or is it sort of more case by case as someone comes in?
I think that's a great question, because I think there's a lot of reasons, number one, that it's not being assessed. Number one, I think people don't know what questions to ask. And number two, they're not sure what to do with the answers, right? So it's kind of like, I just better not talk about this. But I think if we sort of just open the conversation, and the way that I always do this is I really try to normalize it and just make it part of my sort of routine MS review of systems. And I ask all my patients about their bladder function and their bowel function and their sexual function. And I might say something like, because MS can affect sexual function and intimacy in a lot of different ways, I ask all of my patients whether they've noticed any changes in desire, arousal, sensation, orgasm, pain, or intimacy. And I think that gives the patient permission to talk about it in a way that feels matter of fact and rather than awkward. And I emphasize that, you know, this is something really common. And so it's so common that you might be experiencing this too.
Yeah, maybe that's a great place to start, is sort of setting up that stage and that communication piece, because we know, even though we said, you know, this is present in the majority of persons with MS, when we look at the literature, only about 10% of patients with MS are actually getting help with their sexual dysfunction for some of the reasons you mentioned, but communication is one of those pieces. So I love a couple of the things that you suggested, making this routine, bringing it up over time, and people get used to that idea. You normalize it alongside the other symptoms that, you know, that people are commonly experiencing. So it doesn't seem like as big and scary, maybe. And as that relationship perhaps develops, maybe they weren't willing to say something the first time, but they are the second or third as you come back to it. So I really like that. Are there any other elements of that communication piece that you wanted to highlight or call out as you talk about this with your patients?
Yeah, I guess, you know, going back to that sort of sexual cycle, because some patients might say, yeah, I think I am having a problem, and they may not even be exactly sure how to describe the problem. So, you know, there are specific questions we can ask about the sexual cycle. And again, the more we normalize this, the easier it is. So when it comes to desire or libido, you know, we can just ask things like, how strong, you know, have you noticed any changes in your sexual desire or your sex drive, or your interest in sex? And then when it comes to arousal, you know, do you feel physically aroused when you're having, you know, sexual activity? When it comes to, you know, orgasm. And I think, as long as we normalize this and we feel comfortable when we're asking it, it doesn't feel as awkward. And I think a really important question is, like, about the impact on relationships. You know, has this impacted your relationship? Are you, you know, or is this something you've talked to your partner about? Because when, you know, we're talking about communication between the patient and the provider, but so often I also find that, like, one of the really important parts, and we'll get into this when we talk about treatment, is the communication that patient is having with their partner. And so often they're like, oh no, we haven't really talked about this. And I'm like, well, that's somewhere where we do need to go.
I find that challenging sometimes in creating, you know, that safe space and thinking about the other person in the room and when to keep them in the room versus when to throw them out of the room. And I think in your practice, it sounds like it's become such a normal thing. You're not requesting permission to talk about this per se. I would say, I guess I still do the first time. If someone else is in the room, I will request permission, say, you know, I'm going to bring up some sensitive topics, including your bowel bladder function, sex. You know, would you like the person with you to go out in the waiting room, or would you like them here for that? But you're right. It's such a challenging piece because it is better if there's significant others involved in the long run, I think.
Right. But you're right. It's really sensitive. And I think it's a case-by-case situation because sometimes people do want to talk about it with their partner in the room, you know, and sometimes they may not. So I think, you know, this sort of gets to, you got to read the room.
Yeah, I think it sounds like I feel a little bit different than you. I err on the side of tossing out the person's significant other care partner, and then I will request permission to, like, bring them back in and say, you know, I think it would be really helpful if your significant others knew about this, if they knew what to expect in the moment, would that be okay? So I think I sort of err on the side of letting them talk with just me and then bringing the other person back in. But it can take more time, and we're always under time pressure. So it's a balance.
Right. I think that's probably the biggest challenge, right? Nobody thinks they have enough time.
No. And you mentioned, you know, you bring this up with everyone. You're not sorting by those, you know, risk factors, like just people with higher levels of disability or depression, or having people do questionnaires ahead. And that's similar in my practice. I try to bring this up with everybody. You know, it's so prevalent. I don't find those risk factors or screening to be useful. I find, you know, screening is for something more rare and less common. I try to find time to bring it up with everyone, but I do know other colleagues who will do this even as a whole separate visit. And if this comes up in their review assistants, say, you know, this is something that I really want to dive into, spend more time, bring your significant other with you. Let's spend 20, 30 minutes just talking about this. Is that something you ever do?
That absolutely is. Because you're right. For some of these bigger issues, it is a whole visit. And it does take 30 minutes to talk about this. And I think it's worth that visit to give people the time that they need to. And like I said, to really dive into this sort of primary, secondary, and tertiary aspects. Because depending on what the problem is, the treatment is very different, right? Like you know, it's not always that there's like a pharmacologic treatment that's going to fix whatever, you know, that's going to sort of have a global effect on everything. And so I think spending the time to really get a really good history and understand what the problem is can take time, but it's worth it to help find the solution.
All right. Well, I love that. We sort of set the stage for normalizing this, bringing it up with regularity, trying to make it a normal part of practice, but when it needs more time, allowing for that and thinking about the logistics of who are the stakeholders involved here and when to include them. And then as you're moving forward with assessing the sexual dysfunction, where do you go from there?
So again, I think it really depends on, now that you've taken a really good history, we need to figure out, well, what can we do? And so, it might be that the problem is more in that secondary area. So I'll give you an example. I recently saw a patient and she told me that she and her wife are having sexual problems. And I, you know, kept a very open mind. I asked her just some open-ended questions. And then she revealed to me, she's like, I think the biggest issue is I'm worried about my urinary incontinence and I'm worried I'm going to have a bladder problem while I'm having intercourse. And I was like, great, we can fix that. I did not say great, but I'm just saying, like, now that we know that that's sort of like the source of where her problems are, where she's feeling those problems the most, that's like a really good place to start. In another situation, you know, I recently saw another patient and she was just saying, like, I just have no desire. I'm just not interested. And we went through her medications and I noticed that, you know, she's been on sertraline. And I sort of asked a few more questions to sort of look at the timing of, like, when did you start noticing this decrease in your libido, and sort of figured out that it really correlated with her start of the SSRI. And sertraline is known to be a very big offender in the world of, you know, causing lots of various problems in sexual function, not only in libido, but in arousal and orgasm as well. And so we switched her medication to bupropion. And bupropion has actually been shown to be used off-label for female sexual problems. And, you know, she has already noticed some benefit. I'll be perfectly honest, though. I think it's a little too soon for her to notice, like, the dramatic benefit, because many patients, even after discontinuing an SSRI, may have sexual problems for a while. Even after they've discontinued the medication, it's sort of this new phenomenon that people are realizing of post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. But I do think that there, you know, that she may experience some benefit switching off that medication to a different medication that may also help her mood, but potentially help with her libido.
This is wonderful. So yeah, I mentioned earlier, there's barriers for clinicians taking care of patients, we're talking about the communication, the time piece, but this is getting into that other piece, many of us are not super comfortable with knowing what to do with the symptoms that the patients then come back and tell us about. And that decreased libido is definitely one that's come up in my practice too. And I always tell people there's no normal in terms of libido. It's rather, you know, what is your current level of sexual interest and has that changed from a baseline, or is it causing personal or relationship distress? And focusing in on that. And then I love that comments. We use a lot of SSRIs in our patients, sertraline, especially in our women of childbearing age, is a favorite I see in many practices. But considering that switch to bupropion, of course, this is also over time to talk about maybe getting into cognitive behavioral therapy and getting someone linked in my practice for that too. I don't know a ton about hypoactive sexual desire and use of some of the medications for that, but I know there's been changes there as well. I think I use a lot of bupropion or buspirone when it comes up in my practice too. But before we jump off of decreased libido, any others you wanted to add to that one before we jump into another symptom or two?
Well, I'm glad you brought up that there are these medications. There's now two FDA approved medications for female hypoactive sexual desire dysfunction. And one was approved in 2015 and one was approved in 2019. Neither of these drugs have been studied in patients with neurogenic sexual dysfunction. I don't think that we have enough evidence to show that these would be of benefit. And I also am not sure that if you really look at the studies, you know, the effects are modest. So I would hate to prescribe one of these medications and then have a patient feel disappointed that it didn't live up to some expectations that they were hoping for.
That's a really good added insight. Appreciate that. All right. Well, maybe it would be fair to cover another couple of symptoms that come up commonly that I think maybe neurologists are a little bit less comfortable with. One you mentioned earlier was impaired vaginal lubrication. Of course, that can be in that primary category of sexual dysfunction for people with MS, but still, I think many of us don't know what to do in that situation. Any tips there?
Yeah, I think a few things. The first is look at the medication list, right? This gets in again to that sort of secondary sexual problems, but so many people are on medications that might have anticholinergic side effects, or they're on an antimuscarinic, you know, for bladder dysfunction. And they're, you know, part of it's almost iatrogenic. Like the medications that we're giving people might be contributing to this problem. But I recently helped author, I'm one of the authors on the recently approved guidelines for neurogenic sexual dysfunction and neurogenic bladder dysfunction that were written for the European Academy of Neurology and now endorsed by the American Academy of Neurology. And one of the key recommendations is just vaginal lubricants. You know, I feel like using a lubricant can be really helpful for a lot of people. And it's the 9 easy thing to try. And then the other thing that I often talk to women about, and, you know, if people don't feel comfortable talking about this, they can recommend that they talk to their primary care or GYN about this. But especially in postmenopausal women, a lot of postmenopausal women really benefit from vaginal estrogen, which can significantly help with things like lubrication.
Yeah, I think that's a big, like you said, that topical estrogen when there's vulvovaginal atrophy, moving into that postmenopausal stage. I'm not doing a lot of pelvic exams in my office, but I think that's one I definitely refer folks to their OBGYN to consider and think about if they're in that age category. But you're right, water-soluble lubricants are really convenient, usually satisfying fix for many people that I have folks come back and said, I wish someone had just, you know, mentioned this to me sooner. All right. Well, I'd love to cover orgasmic dysfunction too. I think this comes up a lot and scares off a number of people in the neurology field, if you don't mind.
To be honest, I feel like this is the much harder one, right? And I think oftentimes I find that if you're not helping the thing sort of upstream of that, you know, or sometimes I find that if you sort of help the things upstream of the orgasmic function, then you can help that too. So, you know, helping people with things like libido and arousal, you might be able to help enhance orgasmic function. But I will say, I think it's less known, but SSRIs can significantly impact orgasmic function as well. And so it's just something to keep in mind and keep on your radar.
Yes, that's one of my biggest first moves there too. I've seen some evidence as well for orgasmic dysfunction for vacuum and vibratory clitoral stimulation if you've got a female in front of you. But this one I find a little bit complex too. So those are a couple of places I commonly start.
Part of our recommendations too in the guidelines. So
yes, and that's a wonderful shout out too for people who want to read it and see more. And so glad that those are being updated and to see, you know, the attention on the national stage and international stage for this too. We've talked a little bit about comfort level of people in the neurology field with this. I've mentioned sometimes I'm doing this on my own. Sometimes I'm referring out. In your opinion, how much of treating symptoms of sexual dysfunction should fall to the neurology providers? Are there clear times when you're involving mental health providers, urogynecology, other folks?
I think that is a great question because I think that's actually probably one of the most important questions of like, when is it appropriate? When do we need another specialist to help? And I think it's definitely something to keep in mind because there's only so much that neurologists can do and only so much you can do in your neurology office. But I think, you know, when it comes to females, if there's significant psychosocial factors, especially including things like a past history of trauma that could be possibly impacting intimacy, I think that's a really important thing that someone might be should certainly be referred to a mental health specialist. Or even if there's any significant behavioral health comorbidities, you know, if someone's dealing with significant depression or anxiety, those are also really important reasons that they should be should get appropriate behavioral health help. And other things like if there's any abnormal findings in blood tests or suspicion of hypogonadism or endocrine dysfunction, I think those are really important reasons to refer to a specialist. And if they've, you know, you've tried a few things and they've had an inadequate response and you need help, you know, I think that that's another important reason. And then the final thing, I think if someone's having significant pain or bleeding during sexual activity, those are important reasons to refer to a specialist.
Yeah, it sounds like we practice pretty similarly there. I'd say an ejaculation or if I have any suspicion that there's an anatomical problem, prolapse,
right,
things like that. That's a time where I'm going to need help too. And like you said, I'm pretty quick to involve psychology support because even if they're telling me it's things like decreased vaginal lubrication or diminished sensation, that can have psychological impacts as you, you know, try to carry out that relationship with your partner or partners.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Cameron, kind of set the scene with the scope of the problem, bringing it up in the office, normalizing some of these symptoms, some strategies for treating common symptoms. Maybe it would be great to wrap up and think a little bit about what's new in this field in our understanding or treatments of sexual dysfunction in the last few years. Anything that's caught your attention in the field recently?
I think the biggest thing is that people are talking about it. You know, I think it's really neat to see that there even are studies about it. I think for a really long time, this is just something that has not been well studied, has not been well researched. And even you brought up like the meta-analysis, even the fact that people are looking at prevalence a little bit more closely and what are the risk factors, I think is really exciting. There's been some other recent studies looking at certain types of treatments. So one, for example, is posterior tibial nerve stimulation. This is something that has been used actually quite a bit to treat bladder dysfunction. And it's quite benign. It's, you know, it can be done either percutaneously or transcutaneously, where, you know, there's and the idea is this neuromodulation. If you stimulate these nerves in the peripheral nervous system and by the posterior tibia or the posterior tibial nerve, that somehow has some interaction with the interneurons and the sacral nerve roots. You know, don't ask me to fully explain how it all works because I don't think anybody knows. But there was a recent study that actually was looking at this for improvement in sexual function. And even though these are small numbers, it was really intriguing to see that this was helpful. And it was actually helpful in the areas of the sexual cycle that you would most expect. Of, you know, what's mediated by the parasympathetic nervous system, which is essentially, you know, that arousal component, the lubrication and ejaculation. So the idea that somehow, you know, the posterior tibial nerve is interacting with those sacral nerve roots and that might have a meaningful impact is neat. But more broadly, it's just neat that someone's thinking about neuromodulation to improve sexual function.
Yes, this has been something I've been starting to use more and refer folks to in my practice. And I think you're right in talking about some of the logistics. Other things I tell people to expect is usually you're going for a weekly session. It was like 8 to 12 weeks based on the studies, and that they may experience, you know, tingling in the pelvic floor or in the foot when they're getting this treatment. And that's actually a good sign. So kind of a weird idea sometimes for people to get their heads around, and always a little tricky when we're like, it doesn't exactly know why this works. We know about sacral neuromodulation, but an exciting area, and maybe there'll be more to that to come in the next couple of years too. I think one of the other exciting areas that I've seen, we're just scratching the surface of, is people looking at hormone level changes in this field, and what, you know, associations do we see in men, drops in women, in women, lower levels of beta estradiol and androgestrone and others. I think for me, that's not ready for moving into practice yet, because if I'm going to manipulate someone's hormones, that could have a lot of other effects. But it's something I'm excited to see where the field is going to go.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said I don't think it's ready for prime time, because I don't want to encourage people to start testing hormones in practice. Number one, I think that's sort of beyond the scope of what a neurologist should do. But the hormone literature is also challenging because, you know, hormones, so much depends on For example, in a woman, so much depends on where they are in their cycle. You know, if they're perimenopausal or postmenopausal, or you know, and so it's hard to really interpret like any sort of single value of hormones. And similarly with testosterone, there are so many differences in assays in terms of like laboratories and methods of how testosterone is measured. I actually had a patient yesterday ask me if I would measure his testosterone level. And I said no, because of this reason. I'm like, it's hard to interpret the answer. So I don't think we should do that.
Testosterone is still the one I get asked about the most. Studies showing that males with MS may have lower testosterone. But I think it's really interesting in the DePauli study I was talking about, too, that looked at hormone levels. They actually found testosterone levels did not differ between males who had sexual dysfunction and males who did not have sexual dysfunction. So I'd say even more reason that I stay away from this too with the recent data. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation, getting to walk through this with you. And maybe it'd be great just to wrap up a couple of key points you want to leave our listeners with. And maybe one thing, if you could pick just one that you encourage people to start doing in practice tomorrow.
Sure. I guess, you know, my biggest take home is that sexual dysfunction in MS is common. And it's rarely caused by just one thing. And it usually reflects some interaction among neurologic changes, MS symptoms like fatigue, spasticity, bladder issues, mood, relationship context, and the medications that we're all prescribing. So one thing I would encourage and all listeners to do tomorrow is to simply start asking about sexual health in a routine, matter-of-fact, non-judgmental way. I think that's the most important thing that we can do.